Do any of you remember, for some of you, it's going to be a long way. Do any of you remember playing Foursquare as a kid? Anybody play Foursquare as a kid? Okay. It's not just a Northwest thing. You did that out here in the middle of the country too? All right. Good. I remember I was a Foursquare champion. But, I mean, if they had championships for Foursquare, I probably would have been one. It was probably because I was, you know, a couple feet taller in elementary and intermediate school than anybody else in my class. So that's leverage, and it helps. And I enjoyed playing Foursquare, played a lot of Foursquare, White City, elementary and intermediate schools, out on the playground, always playing Foursquare. If you don't know about Foursquare, it's a big square and has four other squares in it. It's a super creative name for it, four squares for four squares. And you serve the ball into somebody else's square, and then they had to hit it back to you or hit it to somebody else. And if you hit a line or you went out of the squares, then you were out and you rotated, and you wanted to get to the point where you were serving. And the longer you were serving, the better you were, right? That's how you got, like, you worked your way up to that. Stayed in until you made a mistake. But here's the reason I liked Foursquare the most over any other game that we played on the playground. If you were serving, and on your serve you mistakenly hit it out of the squares, or you hit a line when you were serving, you could yell, "Do over," and you got the ball back, and you got to serve again. Very rarely did I make the same mistake twice. And so I got to play Foursquare. It was really, really good. We've been looking at Jesus' time in the wilderness in this series. He's baptized by John in the Jordan River, and then he goes to the east side of the Jordan into what the Israelites referred to as the wilderness. It was kind of undiscovered territory. It was unworked ground, the desert. It was symbolic of the Exodus and the 40 years that Israel wandered in that desert region. They crossed from the desert on the east side of the Jordan across to the west side and into the promised land. Jesus makes an opposite trip. He goes from the west side and is baptized, and then goes to the east, and he spends 40 days in the desert wilderness where he doesn't eat. He's fasting and he's praying and he's talking to God, his Father, and then at the end of 40 days, the devil shows up and begins to tempt him. And we've been looking at that specifically over the last 3 weeks. We've been looking at this temptation, what they meant, what they were, how they fit in, and how for the nation of Israel and for us reading about it and looking back, Jesus' temptations in the wilderness was a symbolic do-over for the nation of Israel and their wandering in the wilderness and in the desert. And so what we find out is that Jesus reversed the failures of Israel. Israel's failure to completely obey, to completely to surrender, to completely abide by the grounds of the covenant that God had made with them in the wilderness. And we've been looking at this, how this stretches from Jesus and back into history. And while the temptations of Jesus, like you read them, and sometimes, like we've looked at this over the last few weeks, they kind of appear to be just about one thing, but then we realize that, no, there's a much deeper meaning, there's bigger things going on than just what's there. And it wasn't hard to see Satan's objective once we engaged a little bit with the text. And so we followed Jesus and then Satan's quotes of Moses, primarily from Deuteronomy. And then from there, we go back to Exodus and the story of Israel as they left Egypt. The three tests of Israel in the wilderness. So the first 40 days after they leave Egypt, they cross the ocean, and they go 40 days before they make it to Mount Sinai. And in those 40 days, God issued three tests of Israel. And the first test was more challenging to kind of unravel than the other two. The other two were a little more obvious. The first one is a little, like, you got to dig a little bit. But what we're going to do today, by the way, if you want to see those, you want to be refreshed on those, you can go to the website reallife.faith. You click watch, listen, and all of those are in the playlist, the wilderness playlist, and you can go back and refresh on those. But we're going to spend our time today looking at those three tests. So we've spent the last 3 weeks looking at Jesus' temptations and how they tied back. Now we're going to look specifically at the tests that God gives Israel as they march out of Egypt and towards Mount Sinai. And the first test that Israel faces is a test at this place called Marah. It was called Marah because Marah means bitter or rebellious, and this is kind of where they went. So they leave the ocean. They just have observed the Egyptian army being completely destroyed. They go 3 days into the wilderness. At 3 days into the desert, they're running out of water. I don't think they were out. I think they were running out, and that began to get them worried and afraid. And because they were afraid that they might run out of water, they stopped following God. Because remember, they don't know where God's leading them. God knows. He's taken them around the corner from where they end up to 12 springs and 70 palm trees. It's this place of abundance, but they don't know that. And they begin to get afraid that they're going to run out of water and they're going to die in the desert. And so they stop following God and they start looking for water, trying to fend for themselves. And they find this well. They find this well 30, 60 feet deep, I don't know, very, very deep, a single well in the desert. And they were very excited until they discovered that the water in the bottom of that well had gone stagnant and stale, and it was unfit to drink. And now they're upset. And of course, they're upset at God. Now, they didn't know where God was leading them. They just know where they're at. They're running out of water. They're nervous. They're afraid they're going to die. They're going to die of thirst out there. They found this well. They thought salvation had come. And then they can't drink the water. And now they're going, God, you got to do something. We're going to die. We're going to die of thirst out here in the desert. You've got to do something. And so their fear overcame their faith, and they got stuck. Now, this story is found in Exodus chapter 15, and I'm not gonna read it all because there's a lot of stuff to cover today. But I want to just point out a couple things, maybe. The first of all, it happens in verse 25, and it says, "The Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them." So that's the first test mentioned. 3 days into their 40-day journey to Mount Sinai, which then, of course, turns into 40 years. And so the question is, if you read the text, you look through it up on the screen, the question is, God says, I'm going to make a statute and a rule for you, and then there's no statute or rule. Did you see that? God says, look, if you listen to me and you follow me, I'm not going to bring any of the diseases on you that I brought on Egypt. And then he just moves on. And we're left going, where's the statute and the rule? What are they supposed to follow? What are they supposed to do? It doesn't make any sense. He just says, I'm going to make a statute and rule, and then he never gives them the statute and rule. So we have to go back to the ancient Jewish rabbis, the teachers, the Midrash, the Talmud, and we go, okay, shed some light on this. You guys who are closest to it and understand it and the culture and the context, tell us what was going on. And those ancient Jewish rabbis give us a lot of good information. In fact, they tell us that the test of God at Marah was this. When you are in the desert and you don't know where you're going, you're just following the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud, here's the deal. When you find water, when I bring you to water, when I lead you to water, I want you to let the sick, the infirm, the injured, the old, the young, the stragglers, and the strugglers drink first. Okay. Well, there's multi-million Israelites. There's probably a few million Egyptians, millions of people out in the desert. And when you come to water, you got to let the stragglers and the strugglers, you got to let them drink first before those of you who are well and able. Those of you, if you think about it, those of you who've been carrying the packs and driving the herds and taking care of other things, you need to wait and make sure that those who are often left behind get to drink first. Now imagine, just for a moment, this is the test and the rule. Let the stragglers and strugglers go first, and you come to a single well in the middle of the desert. Your jugs and your jars and your skins, they're running out of water, and you're afraid. And you have to let the strugglers and the stragglers go first. Now, there's a hole in the ground for this well, 30, 60 feet, maybe deeper. It's very big at the top, and then it kind of goes like a funnel down to the bottom. And in the side walls of that curvature all the way around to the bottom are cut in steps all the way down. Now, not very big steps. It would be surprising if two people maybe very carefully could pass each other. But it would not be very safe to do that, probably. And so you've got to go all the way down to the bottom of that well to fill up your jug, and then you've got to walk all the way back up. And when you get to the top, you don't get a drink. You have to give it to those people who are the stragglers and the strugglers. That's a difficult thing. It would have taken the Israelite people a really long time to water everybody, including their flocks and herds, from one single well. And you go, why would God lead them there? Because he wasn't leading them there. He was leading them around the corner to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water bubbling up, and everybody would have had as much as they wanted, and it would have been great. They just didn't know that. And so they stopped following God, and they tried to make their own way. They tried to meet their own need. And when we do that, it gets difficult. So it's at this well that God tests Israelites' heart. The Jewish people believed that was where their will was, their will to follow God or to do it on their own, to do it their own way. It's why probably they named the well Marah, not because the water was bitter, but because it was there that the people rebelled against God. They stopped following him and they started trying to do it on their own. But I think they did, to the best of their ability, try to give water to the people who needed it most. So the question is, will you follow God even when he asks something difficult of you? Are you going to do it on your own, or are you going to follow God? Now, I think there's another question that kind of looms out here, and that is, why did God care who got to drink first? What's the big deal? Why is that even a rule and a statute that God would make? Well, to understand that, we have to realize that for the last 200 years, Israel has been forced labor slaves in the land of Egypt. Marty Solomon says Egypt represents empire. Might makes right. And the emperor, Pharaoh, did whatever he wanted to. And so he oppressed and objectified an entire nation of people to build a kingdom for himself. He ruled with an iron fist. Whatever he wanted, he did. And so if you were a Jewish person and you could no longer tend flocks or herds or work in the fields or make bricks or build pyramids or do whatever other jobs they had for you, Egypt just discarded you. You were of no worth to them. Your worth to Egypt was absolutely 100% in your ability to provide for them, to do things by the sweat of your brow and the strength of your hand. Your purpose was completely tied to your ability to produce for empire, for the emperor. But that is not how God wanted this new nation to function. It's not how he wanted the Israelite people to work. And so the question is this: could the people of God see the value in those that every other society and nation in the world marginalized, rejected, and forgot about? That was the purpose of this test in the wilderness. And really, they kind of passed, it seems, because As soon as they leave Mara, this place of rebellion and bitterness, God takes them to a place of abundance in Elim, where he has everything taken care of for them. They have plenty of whatever it is that they need. And after a while of being there, God leads them from there and back into the desert. And we come to test number two, which again involves food, and specifically, it involves bread. And so the test in this case was not about whether or not Israel would give water to the stragglers and the strugglers and obey that. The test here was, I'm going to give them some specific rules, and I'm going to test their soul. Now, the Jewish people believed that the soul was kind of the seat of who you were. It was who you were as a person, or who you were as a nation. Not just your body, not just your will, but really your essence, who you were at the deepest parts of you. And so this is what God is testing. Will they follow my commands? And I think we'll see that it's a little bit more than that. But verse 17 says, the people did as they were instructed. Now, most of them, some of them didn't. There's that in the text too. But the people, for the most part, did what they were instructed. And because of that, each of them had just what they needed. And so God provided this bread for them on the desert floor. They called it manna, because manna in Hebrew means, what is it? Didn't know what it was. It just appeared every morning when the dew cleared away. There was this bread-like substance on the ground. The people would go collect it. And the rule was, for 5 days a week, you go out and you collect enough for one day. And enough for one day per person was an omer. I don't know, maybe somewhere roughly around a quart. That was it for one person each day. But on day six, you could go out and collect 2 omers. And then on day 7, the Sabbath, Saturday, you didn't collect anything. In fact, you weren't supposed to leave your tent. Now, I have always been taught, growing up in church and Bible college and all of that stuff, I had always been taught that this kind of miracle with the manna was an individual miracle. So I'm see if I give example. Like, if I went out one day and I was really ambitious and I collected a gallon of manna, when I got back to the tent and I measured it out for the day, it would have miraculously shrunk to be an omer, so less than what I gathered. But if the next day I went out and I wasn't feeling it, I wasn't 100%, and I didn't gather very much, maybe I gathered a cup, when I went back to the tent and measured it out, it miraculously was an omer. So, I mean, that's kind of cool. Like, he who gathered much didn't have too much, and he who gathered little didn't have too little. But that's the American way to look at things, right? We have a very American way of looking at the Bible and going, well, life is about me. I'm going to pull myself up by my own bootstraps. I'm going to make it on my own. Western culture is all about the individual. And that's how I was taught to interpret this text, that when the families went out, the people went out and they gathered, like, they're, this is miraculous. Sometimes it was more, sometimes it was less, but it was always exactly what each person needed. But I think there's more to it than that. And here's part of why we come to this place. Years ago, I had major back surgery. And for 3 months after that surgery, I had to wear a large plastic turtle shell. So front and back, and went from my neck down to my waist. As soon as I sat up on the edge of the bed in the morning, I had to grab that and strap into it. I had to leave it on all day long. I couldn't take it off until I got back in bed that night to go to sleep. Like the doctor even said, if you get up to go to the restroom in the middle of the night, put the brace on to go. Like, it was not fun. And had I been an Israelite at the time, my manna collection would have been not very good, because I couldn't really bend. I would have had to squat down very carefully all the way to the ground, and it would have been rough. I would not have been able to collect much, if any. And some days, if I was in pain, it would have been none at all. I was also thinking about, what if Andrea and I were Israelites back then and we had Trent? and tried to get him to collect manna in the morning. Well, that probably wouldn't go very well either. I don't think he'd like that very much. Probably wouldn't get very much, if any. So here, I think, is the miracle. I have kind of a new idea of this. I think the nation as a whole, the tribes and their tents and whatever, I think the nation every morning, everybody who was able, got up and went out and collected manna. And some of them were young and strong, and they were able to collect a bunch and stay out there a long time and collect it. And some of them, the strugglers and the stragglers, they weren't able to collect very much. And they went out if they could. They got what they could, but they probably didn't get very much, maybe not even enough just to meet their own need. But somebody else could collect enough for themselves and others. And so what we tend to get, or the idea that we get from the ancient Jewish teaching, is that what happened was everybody went out and collected what they could. They brought it together in stations, and they dumped what they had into like a big pot. And then they went by maybe tribes, and they went by tents. Well, how many people are in your tent? How many people are in your tribe? And then they measured it out an omer at a time for each person in that family, each person in that community, each person in that tribe. And every day at the end, every single person in the nation of Israel received exactly as much as they were supposed to, that omer. As they dispersed it, everybody got exactly what they needed. See, when the people obeyed the Lord, they got exactly what they needed to care for everybody. He met the needs of everyone when the people obeyed. Now, there's some more talk in the text about how they didn't really follow, and there were some people who went out on the day they weren't supposed to, and there were some people who kind of kept it over the next day, and there's reasons for that. But for the most part, the nation as a whole collectively came together and provided for the whole community. And what they were learning was, when you obey God, He shows up and meets the needs of everyone. And so the Israelites, they're beginning to learn what it means to be a part of this community of God and this new nation of God that He was building really from the ground up. They were proving who they were as a people in their soul. They were learning these lessons. This is how God wants us to be in the world around us. So let's look at the last test. It comes in Exodus chapter 17, and we looked at this last week, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. Again, if you want to know, you can go back to the website. You can look it up and get more context there. But in the third test, we learn about this nation called the Amalekites. When Israel left Egypt and crossed through the ocean, they were on their way to Mount Sinai. The Amalekites were the first nation to show up and test them in battle. But the Amalekites were just dirty, rotten scoundrels, right? They didn't fight fair. So as the nation was walking, and apparently the stragglers and the strugglers were left behind in this millions of people marching through the desert, and the Amalekites would come and they'd pick off all of those people at the rear. I think we looked last week at how Moses said, Amalek, cut off your tail. They killed off the people who were at the very back of the line. In fact, God's going to fix that later, and He's going to make the tribe of Dan bring up the rear and kind of protect everybody as they're marching. Anybody tries to come at you from behind, Dan is going to be there to fend them off. But in this moment, in Exodus 17, the Amalekites have drawn battle lines to face Israel head on. They've picked off a bunch of them at the tail end, and now they're going to face them head on. Remember, we talked last week about how Israel had been slaves for 20 years. They didn't have a military. They probably didn't have very many weapons at this point. It's whatever pitchforks and stuff they could carry out of Egypt with them. They probably didn't have shields and spears and swords and all that kind of stuff. They were farmers and bricklayers. So wasn't a lot of military prowess here. And I think Amalek thought they could do something. Now they saw the pillar of fire and cloud. They saw God there. They knew what God had done to Egypt, the God of the Hebrews had done to Egypt, and they just didn't care. They thought they were going to make an example of Israel, and so they came out against them to fight. And here's the interesting thing. Moses calls Joshua, and he tells Joshua to choose men who will fight for us. That's kind of how the text should read. Choose men who will go out and fight for us. Now, we got to be careful, because in every other moment in Scripture, when Israel sends men to battle, they do not do this. What you find, really, I think every other time that this happens, Moses or Joshua or whoever's leading the people say, go out and find every able-bodied male, 20 years old and older, who can carry a sword, and give them a weapon and send them to battle. It was a draft. You don't have a choice. If you're 20, if you're able-bodied, if you can handle a sword, you are going out to fight no matter what. But in this case, in this instance, the very first time, their days out of Egypt, Moses doesn't say that. He says, Joshua, I want you to go find people who are willing to fight, not just for their family, but for their community. This was a volunteer kind of thing. Are there any people willing to go out and stand in the gap for the people of the community who can't fight for themselves? And apparently he found some. And I wonder if maybe the text doesn't say this, just an opinion, an idea. I wonder if maybe there just weren't very many of them. And that's why the text says that Moses went up onto a hill and he held his arms up and the staff of God in his hands. And when his arms were raised and he was pointing to the pillar, the people of Israel overpowered Amalek. But when he got tired and he dropped his arms, the Amalek overpowered Israel. And maybe it was because there just weren't very many of them and they needed God's help to do that. And eventually they do overthrow. They defeat Amalek and they chase him off. They're going to continue to fight with them for a few more generations. But they win that battle and they drew strength from not just seeing Moses on the mountain, but from the presence of God among them in the pillar of fire and cloud. And they defeated Amalek. Now, I mentioned earlier that God wanted to do something different with Israel. They had lived under the national structure of Egypt, of empire and emperor, for more than 400 years. And the last 200 years of that time in Egypt, they were forced slaves. They built a lot of stuff there for Egypt. God wanted his people to act differently. Egypt was all they knew. Emperor and empire and might makes right was all they knew, but God wanted them to learn something different and to act differently from all the nations around. He wanted his nation to care for the sick and the disabled and the weak and the slow, the stragglers and the strugglers. And so the question is, are you beginning to see a pattern here in these tests? See, Egypt was focused on might. God's people were to be focused on mercy. Egypt was about conquering. God's people were supposed to be about community. And through these three tests, God asks Israel, what kind of a nation are you going to be? This is who I want you to be. Are you able to set aside everything you know about nation building and follow me? And do what I've told you to do. Would you love me enough with your heart and your soul and your might? That was the last test. To follow me into this new way of living, this new way of being a nation. And I think in part the answer was yes. But man, they struggled. They had a hard time fully obeying and following God. But I want to make a few other observations. These are just arbitrary observations, okay? This isn't this super spiritual stuff. I just think it's really cool. I want you to notice something. In John chapter 2, Jesus performs his first miracle. And his first miracle involves water, which I think is pretty interesting. Now, it's not that they didn't have enough water, but there was something they didn't have enough of, and it was wine. God turns water into wine, but really more importantly, he turns lack into abundance. And it sounds a lot like the first test of Israel in the wilderness, and really a lot like the first temptation of Jesus and Satan there too. In Matthew chapter 14, Jesus feeds 5,000 men on a hillside, and including women and children. There was lots of people there. A little later in his story, he's going to feed, that was 5,000 Jewish people. A little later in the story, he feeds 4,000 non-Jewish people, Gentile people, and their wives and kids. And the common denominator in those two stories is bread. Jesus takes a small amount of bread, and it miraculously appears and feeds all of the people so that there is more than what they need. I think that's a pretty cool connection. In Matthew chapter 27, Pilate is going to show up. Pilate is the Roman governor in charge of Judea, the Israeli people. And Pilate's going to ask three questions. And because of the way Jesus responds, or maybe doesn't respond, we're supposed to see something very clearly. We're supposed to see Jesus as a willing sacrifice for his community, which really is all of creation. Jesus says, I will go and fight for these people who cannot fight this battle for themselves. Now, if you haven't figured it out yet, church, this church, you and I are the people of God. And we are wandering in a desert wilderness. We are wandering in a foreign land. We are wandering in a world that doesn't often make sense to us, a world of empire and emperor, a world that says, this is how you live, might makes right. We see that today in multiple nations around the world. Russia has invaded Ukraine. Why? Because they can. And who's going to stop them? This is the way the world works, and we are in this world, but we're not supposed to be of this world. We're wandering in a desert, and really, we don't know where we're going, where God is leading us, what he's going to take us to, and what he's going to take us through, but we are just doing our best to follow him and look more like Jesus every day. And we don't look, we're not supposed to look like the nations and the people and the worlds around us. The way that you and I today, outside of Israel, show that we love God with our heart and our soul and our might was the same way that Israel was supposed to reveal that to God thousands of years ago. How will we respond to those in our community? How do we live in a world that is so vastly different from the way we know God wants us to live and how he wants us to be? Will we choose might over mercy? Will we choose conquering over community? Will we make sure that I have enough, as long as I've got what I need, I don't care about anybody else. I don't care about the strugglers and the stragglers, the injured and infirm, the young and the old. As long as I have what I need, as long as I've provided for my family, I'm not worried about anything else. Now, I'm going to do something that I really don't like to do, and I know some of you are going to get this, and you're probably not the people who need to get it. Some of you are not going to get it, and you may be the people who need to get it. And I'm just, like, this makes me uncomfortable. And probably is going to make you uncomfortable. And sometimes maybe we just need to be uncomfortable. There are two areas here at Real Life that just drive me crazy and I struggle with personally more than any other. They are areas and things that just come up in conversation in our staff meetings, our management team meetings all the time, and we just don't know what to do about it. We never have enough volunteers in our welcome team ministry and our Life Kids ministry. Never. We never have. We've been a church for 18 years, almost August or May, 18 years May. We've never had enough volunteers in our Life Kids ministry or in our welcome team ministry. And I know, like, you see Pam out there, and she does a fantastic job. And I've talked to people who have said, well, like, Pam does so good, and I just don't know if I can be that good. No, you can't be, okay? Let's just, like, yeah, she's pretty good at that. But that doesn't mean we don't need more people to stand at the, like, we've got two entrances now. Did you know that? Like, we're getting very close to being done with the Life Kids lobby. It would be amazing if we could have somebody over there at those doors welcoming people when they come in the building. It would be amazing if we could have some people at the doors here into the auditorium, not just the doors out front. Tracy was there opening the, let me just tell you, Tracy had a rough week this week. And he was here this morning. I think you smiled at most people, didn't you? Opening the door when they came in. At the doors, somebody at the auditorium doors handing out bulletins, just welcoming people, help them find a seat. Like, we just need more people. I know Amber doesn't want any of her volunteers to work 2 weeks in a row. She wants to give those families and people an opportunity to come in here and to worship and to be a part of what's going on in this room. But that often means that she's back there with all of our children by herself in that two age group range. I'm thankful that we have somebody who's willing to do that, because you know what? I would not. And I have told her before, if you are going to be back there by yourself, bring all the kids back in the auditorium. You don't have to do that. We struggle with that. And I wonder, how can we care for our community, not just this community, but the greater community of people who walk in, if we struggle to welcome our guests and regulars and teach our kids about Jesus on their level? Like, we have got to figure this out. If we are going to grow as a church, if we are going to share Jesus with people, we have got to figure this out. Now, I am open for suggestions. If you've got them, I'm willing to hear them, because we cannot figure this out. It's becoming a problem, and it's keeping us from living up to our calling. That's why I'm going to offer this week's challenge before we get to our decision time. And so just here's the challenge. This week, the next 7 days, take a hard look at your life and yourself, how you are loving God and how you're loving the community around you. I'm talking about two communities there, how you're showing love to people outside of our church that you come in contact with at work or at the grocery store or whatever. But I'm also talking about how you show love to the people who are in this room right now. How do we be this community? And I want you to ask some questions of yourself. In the way that I function and interact at Real Life, am I being helpful or am I being hurtful to what's going on and to the call of God to help every person possible find real life in Jesus and look more like him every day? And maybe the second part of that is, do I spend time complaining about the church and about the preacher and about the kids ministry or whatever? Do I spend time contributing to improve those things, or do I just consume? Do I just come, and as long as I've got what I need, I'm okay and I'm out the door? Do you find that you're good to care for yourself, but maybe not caring for others the way you know God would want you as part of the community? Those are tough questions, and I'm just, like I told you beforehand, this is going to be uncomfortable. It's not, I don't enjoy talking about that. But it's here. That's what God was trying to do with the nation of Israel. It's what he's still trying to do today. Jesus told his disciples, they're going to know, the people outside of this room with us are going to know that we are God's people by the way that we love each other. And yes, the way that we love people outside of the church, but if we love people outside and then they get here and they find out we're just a bunch of jerks to each other, they don't come back anyway. So we got to love each other, and we got to come together as a community here, and then we got to be the community to other people. And I know that's difficult, and I know we're busy, and I know we got things going on, but I know we need to get this, and we need to figure it out. We want to be a community that cares. And so this morning, if you need to pray with somebody, if you want information about baptism, about how to live and look and love more like Jesus, whatever your need is this morning, whatever God, maybe you just need to pray with somebody, you got stuff going on in your life. We want to care for you and be the community for you. And so right now, or in a few minutes when the service is over, you can head out those back doors and down the hallway and go to our family room. And there's going to be some people in there who've been praying for you this morning already and who are ready to pray with you now. And so if that's where you are, if you've got something on your heart, if God's doing something, you go back to that room and somebody will be back there to meet you and to pray with you and to help you as you need. I hope you take advantage of that. And, you know, sometimes I think as churchy people, we're like, I don't want to do that because somebody might think I got problems and stuff in my life. Yeah, we think that. You come to this church. You got problems. We know. There's no hiding that. And so if you need something, they want to help you. They want to pray with you. They want to connect with you and be community with you. And I hope you'll do that. Let's just wrap up this with prayer. Father, I fail and have failed often at being the kind of person that you want me to be and how I function in this community. God, I think we all struggle with it. And so, God, would your spirit lead us and guide us and direct us? And instead of going, well, wait for somebody to ask, or I just don't know, or it's whatever, God, I just pray that we'd be a people who would just, like, you see a need, you meet a need. That's what we need to be. God, would you help us to be the kind of community here at Real Life that other people would look at and go, I want to be a part of what God is doing there, because it's obvious that God is doing something. And so, God, would you help us to be that, to be what you called the light, the city on a hill whose light can't be hidden and everybody around sees it. And we're only going to do that when we come together and we love as the community of King Jesus that we are. And so help us to do that. God, I thank you for all of the people here who serve and give and help and love and work. God, thank you for who you've brought and how you've built us together, and pray that you'd continue to do that, and we'd each step in and step up and serve each other because of our love for you. And you help us do that, God, in Jesus' name, amen. One of the things that I think is great about community and the community of God specifically is that while everybody's not at the same level, nobody's at the same place, what we give, how we serve, everybody is at a different place. Everybody gives and serves differently and at different levels. But when we all do that together, every need gets met. That's the way God intended the church to function. And we aren't a church full of doctors and doctors and lawyers and politicians, people with really deep pockets. We're blue-collar workers and public servants just doing our best. And life sometimes is difficult and it's hard. But when we each give as God lays on our hearts, things get done. And God always finds a way to meet the needs of his people and community when his people and community are committed to him, trusting him and following him, even when we're not always sure where he's leading us. And so if God moves your heart today, we invite you to trust him with your finances the way you trust him with your future and your eternal life, and you give to him as he moves your heart. We've got a few ways to do that. There's a bucket in the back for cash or check, and there's giving envelopes back there. You can go to reallife.faith and click the orange icon when it pops up in the bottom right-hand corner, and you can give that way. And I just thank you for being a part of what God's doing. I'm excited. I think by the end of this year, we'll have our Life Kids ministry done. We'll have our fellowship room done, and we've got plans to redo the auditorium, stage lights, tear that wall down, a bunch of things. And I think we could get it done by the end of the year while we continue to meet needs and help people and be the community God's called us to be. So thank you. Thank you for giving.